Okay, well, we're gonna get started. And giving the impression that we're not giving any reporting support today, so left over here, because you would be able to catch up on the lecture under something happens. But anyway, so we're here, so we might as well get started. Okay, so we're starting a new chapter in the course, so we've talked about congruences. And now I'm going to talk about hypersurfaces. And in the case of null hypersurfaces and null congruences, we have a direct link, as we already talked about when we were talking about null cones. And the main context for the discussion of hypersurfaces here is that, you know, at some point we're going to be talking about black holes, so I keep promising this, but it won't come. We will talk about black holes, and when we talk about black holes, well, probably the most interesting aspect of black holes is the event horizon, and the event horizon is an example of a null surface. So when we're talking about hypersurfaces, we're talking either about null hypersurfaces, that's going to be, you know, the main interest for us, but it could be time-like, it could be space-like. And before I say all of this, I should have said that a hypersurface is basically just a three-dimensional submanifold of our four-dimensional spacetime. So it's, you know, if we were talking about 3D space, we would be talking about a surface, because we're talking about four-dimensional spacetime, we're talking about hypersurfaces, so it's just a 3D submanifold. And there are basically three possibilities for the nature of that hypersurface. So it could be a space-like surface. And that would mean that all the directions that are intrinsic to that surface are spatial directions, and the normal direction would be a time-like direction. So that would be an example. Another example would be a time-like surface. And that would be a situation where we have one time-like direction on the surface, intrinsic to the surface, in two spatial directions, and the normal direction would be space-like. And then, you know, the other possibility is that we might have a null surface, I'll draw it as a light cone, because that's what we've encountered already, but that could be a piece of the event horizon. So that would be an example of a null surface where we have a null direction intrinsic to the surface, two space-like directions, and then the, you know, the other direction that we might define in the spacetime would be a transverse null direction. So one null direction, two spacetime directions, and the normal that actually, you know, coincides with one of the tangent vectors on the surface. So to describe these types of surfaces, space-like or time-like, it's relatively straightforward. To describe null surfaces is a bit more subtle because, you know, of that, you know, fact that when we're talking about null surfaces, what is defined to be the tangent vector, sorry, the normal vector is also a tangent vector, and it happens to be tangent to the null geodesics that live on that surface. So because of that null nature, there's interesting subtleties that arise, and that will require a separate discussion that we'll be able to take into a description of black holes. So I'll start with those two cases here, and then, you know, at some point I'll come back to the null case and introduce all the subtleties that need to be covered in that case. Now, so what's, you know, what's the reason for considering hypersurfaces? Well, when we consider space-like hypersurfaces, we're really talking about, in a meaningful geometrical way, what we might describe as a moment in time in a four-dimensional spacetime. So when we talk about a moment in time, typically we want to go away from the notion that we're talking about a surface t equal constant, because in curved spacetime, what is t? Well, we don't know. T can be anything, but the notion of being space-like for a hypersurface is something that has clear geometrical meaning, and the notion of moment of time is something that is really well captured by a space-like surface.
Sorry, I don't have the voice properly.
Oh,
unlinked.
Any of that?
And you didn't put the mic on too.
Yeah, so the mic is here, but the battery is.
Yep.
And are you recording
today? Yes, it is recording right now.
I'm doing the recording. It's someone else right now.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, so sorry about the sound not being good for the first part of the lecture. I was waiting for a fresh battery, but now it has come. So I'm sorry if you missed some of that, but I think you'll be able to catch on.
Thank you.
All right, so a space-like hypersurface is something that we can describe as a moment of time in space-time defined as arbitrarily as, as we can in the context of a four-dimensional space-time. And the kind of thing that we might think about when we're talking about a moment in time is, is in terms of the initial value problem of, a field theory in general, but in, for general relativity in particular. So the idea of, setting up field equations in physics is often phrased in the following terms. So you give me initial data, and then the field equations will allow me to propagate this initial data into the future. And then, when you go into a question like this more deeply, well, you have to provide, the description of the initial data. So what is, meaningful, appropriate initial data for an initial value problem of general relativity? And that's something we'll talk about, and that's something that's going to be formulated in terms of a space-like hypersurface. So basically, the question would be, what do we need to provide on this surface that will be, good initial data that would be sufficient, information to be able to generate a unique solution to the field equations in the future. So that's the kind of thing that might be, that might provide context for a description of space-like hypersurfaces, and I'll talk about that later, but I'm not going to talk very much about this because that would be a whole, a whole new, a new section of the course that I don't want to go into. So that would be the context. That would be a situation where we might want to discuss the initial value problem of GR, and that's something that, for example, if you're doing numerical relativity, that's something you really want to, formulate in very precise terms, because you want the computer code to start from, enough information to be able to return a solution in the future. For a time-like hypersurface, the context here might be something different. And an example would be, suppose that you want to describe the metric inside and outside a star. And, there are lots of literature devoted to that problem. So we would have the inside of the star. We would have the outside of the star. If the star is static and spherically symmetric, then the metric outside will be described by the Schwarzschild solution. And the metric inside will be whatever you calculate based on the description of the matter inside the star. But what you have over here, at the boundary of the star, what you have is a transition between a metric that describes the inside and a metric that describes the outside. And you would have to, at least, in principle, although it's usually, taken care of, but you would want to be sure that the matching of the inside solution with the outside solution is something that is appropriate according to the field equations. So the boundary here, provides us a region where we want to match two metrics, both inside and outside, and presumably we have to check that some matching conditions are satisfied to provide a smooth joining of the two metrics. And in some cases, we do have that. We have a smooth transition between the inside and the outside, but sometimes we don't, and that's analogous to what you would have in electromagnetism. For example, you might have a boundary somewhere in your situation where the electric field has a discontinuous normal component. And that would translate into the existence of some charge distribution on that boundary. Well, there are similar things that apply to general relativity, and then you would have to decide whether the matching between the inside and the outside metric is okay as it is, or whether it might require the existence of a surface layer at the boundary between the inside and the outside that might need to contain some form of matter in order to ensure that the junction conditions are satisfied. So that boundary here defines a time-like surface in space-time, because you know that boundary extends in time as a time-like surface. And you know, and then you know, if you want to make sure that you know that the two solutions on the inside and the outside are joined properly, then there's some conditions that need to be satisfied, and those are formulated in terms of geometrical quantities that live on that time-like surface. And it so turns out that while there's a pretty, you know, pretty close relationship between those two types of problems, even though conceptually they're quite different, in all cases, what you need to do to provide you know, information about what lives on that surface, that's going to be contained in two tensors, one being the induced metric on the hypersurface, and we'll define that in just a few minutes, and the other one being the extrinsic curvature, something that we'll probably talk about next week. But those are the two things that would provide initial data on a space-like surface, and the field equations could be formulated in terms of evolution equations for those two tensors. And similarly here, if you want to, you know, to ask about matching conditions on that hypersurface, that would also be formulated in terms of the induced metric and the extrinsic curvature. So those geometrical quantities that I'm talking about here that we'll talk about in the next few lectures, well, those are extremely important to the description of hypersurfaces. And for different reasons, but, you know, they're really the meaningful geometrical quantities that you can associate with a hypersurface that describes not just its intrinsic geometry, but also how the surface, you know, bends in the underlying spacetime. So very important quantities here that we'll talk a lot about. But the ultimate motivation, I'll talk a little bit about this, I'll talk a little bit about that, but the ultimate motivation is to really talk about null hypersurfaces, because that's going to be the description of our event horizon. And here the description is very different. We don't really have a notion of extrinsic curvature on that, although you can come up with some, but it's not, you know, it's not the same thing. And the intrinsic metric is a little bit subtle because of that null direction. So we're going to have to come to terms with this, and we will. And that's going to come after we've treated those cases here. Okay, so the first question we need to ask here is, so given that we're dealing with some, you know, four-dimensional space-time, how do we describe a hypersurface, whether it's time-like or null? Sorry, space-like or time-like. And there are basically, there are lots of ways you can do it, but there are two useful ways of doing it. So let's talk about this. And as an example, I'll just talk about the surface of a sphere in three-dimensional space. I think we can introduce the ideas here in the simplest context that way. So suppose that we have a 2D sphere, and I just mean the surface here in 3D space. That would be the an example of a hypersurface, but in a three-dimensional space. And I'll take the sphere to be of radius R. There are basically two ways we can introduce a mathematical description of that sphere. One would be to place a constraint on the coordinates. And what I mean by that is we would say that x squared plus y squared plus z squared, describing, you know, the 3D space in terms of Cartesian coordinates, that has to be restricted to be a constant. So that's obviously the equation of the sphere, and that would be one way of describing, you know, the surface of the sphere. And that has virtues and it has deficiencies, but it's a perfectly valid description. The other one would be to provide what I call embedding, well, not just me, but what are called embedding relations. And the idea here is to provide a description of this, you know, of the surface in terms of intrinsic coordinates. And here, because we're talking about the surface of the sphere, it's natural to use spherical coordinates, two angles on the sphere. So we would draw up lines of constant theta. We would draw up lines of constant phi. And that would give us a perfectly nice coordinate system on the sphere, except for the issues of the poles. But we don't have to be concerned with this. So here we would introduce theta and phi coordinates on the sphere, and we would describe the sphere in terms of relations between the Cartesian coordinates that live in three-dimensional space and those intrinsic coordinates that live on the surface. So basically, we would describe the space, you know, the spatial coordinates, the 3D coordinates in terms, in parametric terms, in terms of the intrinsic coordinates. And well, you know what that description is. We would express the relationship between the Cartesian coordinates and the angular coordinates, and that would also be a description of the surface. So either we do it like this as a constraint, or we do it like this in terms of embedding relations. And it turns out that both, you know, descriptions are nice and complementary, and we can do things with that one, and we can do things with that one that tend to be different things. So they both tend to be useful. And of course, it's important that those two descriptions be compatible, because otherwise you just make a mistake in the description of the hypersurface. So in slightly more general terms, what we would have, and especially if we go back to space-time, we would have either a description in terms of a constraint, and in a space-time formulation, we would say that there's some scalar function of all the coordinates that would be, you know, a constant, or I'll write it as zero, doesn't matter. Let's just say in general, it's going to be a constant. So some constraint like this, but now formulated in terms of all space-time coordinates. Or we would have embedding relations. And that would be a relationship between the space-time coordinates and a system of intrinsic coordinates that I would place on the hypersurface. So if I just, I'm getting squeezed here, but if I just draw this schematically, so that would be my hypersurface. I would lay out some coordinates, and those coordinates can be just as arbitrary as any other coordinate system. So I would have a system of intrinsic coordinates on the hypersurface, and then I would specify the relationship between those coordinates and the space-time coordinates that we use in the four-dimensional manifold. So those would be the space-time coordinates, and those would be intrinsic coordinates on the hypersurface. All right, so that's pretty straightforward, and I think the example of the sphere really, you know, really captures that pretty well, and we'll continue to explore that example as we introduce, you know, new concepts, and I think it'll make things very clear. All right, so that's how we describe hypersurfaces. We have two options, and from those two options, we can define a normal vector to the hypersurface, and we can define a set of tangent vectors to the hypersurface. So let's talk about the normal vector. So for now, I'm still working in four dimensions. So I'll draw it as a space-like surface, but it doesn't really matter. And the idea is that we're going to have a vector that's going to be normal to the hypersurface, which means that it's going to be orthogonal to all of the tangential directions. And this description over here is very useful to define the normal vector, because the normal vector is going to be the direction in which that function changes. Because that function is constant on a hypersurface, it doesn't change in any of the tangential directions. It has to change in the normal direction. So the normal vector has to be, you know, proportional to the gradient of that function. So we've talked about that already. I don't think that will create any surprises. So the normal vector, so we're going to define the normal vector. I'm going to define it fully by, of course, by making two requirements. It's going to be a unit vector. And by unit vector, I mean either it's going to be, you know, unit with a norm of minus one or plus one, depending on whether we're talking about space-like or time-like. So I'll write n alpha as something which is equal to epsilon, which is either plus or minus one. And it's going to be minus one if the normal vector is time-like, which means that the hypersurface is space-like. So I'll say that the hypersurface, let me introduce a symbol for it. The hypersurface, I'll describe it as sigma. And it's going to be minus one if the hypersurface is space-like. And it's going to be plus one if the normal is space-like. And that would mean that the hypersurface itself is time-like. So we have to introduce this sign here that will give us the, you know, the signature of the hypersurface. So that's going to be one requirement, that it's going to be a unit vector. And that's just a convention, but it's a useful convention. I'm going to take the vector to point in the direction of increasing phi. So we have to pick a direction for the normal vector. Either it's going to be pointing that way or that way. And if it's a time-like vector, I probably would want it to point forward in time. And if my function phi is itself increasing forward in time, then that's, you know, that's what we'll get. So I'm going to say that it will point in direction of increasing phi. Now, that's just a convention. There's nothing, you know, that forces us to do that, but it's a useful thing to do. It's just that now we have to, you know, worry a little bit about signs. And when we're dealing with space-like hypersurfaces and time-like vectors, there's always some sign issues that arise. So the normal vector, as I said, is going to be proportional to the gradient of the function phi. And if I, you know, fix this up by making it normal and pointing in the right way, I'm going to have that n alpha is going to be, I have to check, it's going to be epsilon times a normalization factor times the gradient of the function phi, and the normalization factor is going to be the absolute value of the gradient vector, of the norm of the gradient vector. So, and I'm not going to spend too much time justifying this, it's just that if we want to make sure that all the signs work out, we have to put a factor of epsilon here. And mu, of course, I think is obvious. If we want this to be a unit vector, then we have to factor in the norm of the gradient vector. And that's the appropriate factor here. So just as a quick example, so for, you know, I'll work out the example of the sphere in just a moment. But let's consider just, you know, as an example, a t equal constant surface in Minkowski spacetime. Then what I would take phi to be in this case would simply be t, because I'm making the statement that that function of all the coordinates is a constant for that surface. If I take the gradient of this, I get, well, the gradient of t, which is 1, and then the gradient of the other coordinates, well, you know, there's no other component to the gradient. And the issue here is that, well, if I raise the index, that plus one will turn into a minus one. And that would give me a past pointing vector, not a future pointing vector. So that's why I have to fix this up with an epsilon to turn that, you know, past directed vector into a future directed one. So all I'm saying here is that, well, this is already a unit vector. So I could say that n alpha is just this, but I'll still introduce that extra minus sign that comes from the factor of epsilon here to make sure that when I raise the index, that my vector actually points to the future. So that's one of the things that you have to do when you work in a signature where the time direction in the metric is coming with the minus sign. So it's a little bit, you know, that kind of stuff is a little bit of an irritation. Every time you have to do a calculation, you have to think about these things, and sometimes you forget. And then you generate vectors that point to the past. It's not necessarily bad, but it just creates a little bit of, you know, confusion when you're thinking about where things are going. So there's always a bit of care that's required in doing those types of calculations. Okay, so I'll do the sphere in just a moment, but before I do that, I'll introduce the tangent vectors. So here's my hypersurface. And, you know, the way that we always define vectors is through curves. You know, they're always tangent to curves. And what I have to consider, therefore, is to consider a displacement on the hypersurface that stays on the hypersurface. So that would be a displacement entirely on the hypersurface. So I'm drawing a curve that's required to live entirely on the hypersurface. It's not allowed to escape out, you know, into the underlying spacetime. And then a tangent vector will be something that is tangent to that curve. So that's how we would define, a tangent direction in the hypersurface. And what we would like to do is to introduce a whole, basis of those, because we have three tangential directions that we would like to define here. So an intrinsic displacement is something that's really really well described for us by the embedding relations, because the embedding relations tells us what happens to the space-time coordinates if I make a change in the intrinsic coordinates. And that means, take one point on the hypersurface and displace it to a neighboring point. Yep.
Could a continuous manifold contain both space-like and time-like parts?
Space-like and time-like what?
Parts. Can you stitch together a space-like and time-like surface and have it be continuous?
You mean so going from space-like to time-like in a continuous way?
Yeah.
Sure, you can do that. But there's going to be a little corner where the surface momentarily goes null.
Right.
Right.
Would it still be differentiable, though?
Yeah, we can do it in a differentiable way. Yeah. All right. So what I'm saying here is that so we have the embedding relations, and if I choose to change the intrinsic coordinates in those relations, I will be describing curves on, curves on the hypersurface. So this way of describing it, and I think the diagram on the sphere makes it clear, we're talking about curves on the hypersurface, and we can define the basis vectors or the tangent vectors on the hypersurface to be tangent to those curves. So all I'm saying here is that if I want to describe a displacement, all I have to do is to differentiate this, and differentiating this means taking all of my embedding relations, differentiating all of them with respect to the intrinsic coordinates, and then multiplying by the increment in the intrinsic coordinates. So those, if I divide by parameter, will give me tangent vectors on the hypersurface. And I can think of this coefficient here, those partial derivatives, as giving me a set of tangent vectors in the spacetime, on the hypersurface. So I'll just write it as, I'll introduce that notation. And what I'm saying here is that by taking all of those partial derivatives, I'm defining a set of vectors that will be tangent to all the curves y equal constant on the hypersurface. So the notation here is that we can construct those basis vectors tangent to the hypersurface by just taking our embedding relations and constructing all those partial derivatives. Those are going to be tangent vectors because they are, tangent to curves that are defined purely on the hypersurface. And we have three of them because we have three independent intrinsic coordinates on the hypersurface. So that gives us a basis on the hypersurface. And it's a purely tangential basis. So that's an object that has an interesting identity in terms of, tensorial identity. It's actually a vector when we view it as something that lives in space-time. because, you know, the index here, you know, confirms that. And it comes from, you know, an object here that is a proper vector in space-time. But it's also a covector when we view it as an object that lives purely on the hypersurface. So it's a sort of hybrid object that behaves as a tensor in space-time, but behaves as a covector when we view it as an object, geometrical object, on the hypersurface. And that, again, is, you know, motivated by the placement of the index here and the fact that while we are talking about a gradient quantity, one for each one of the space-time coordinates, and a gradient is, you know, a covector when viewed in proper geometrical terms. So just to mention that, so this is a space-time vector. But it's also a hypersurface covector. And the idea here is that while the indices, you know, tell us what these things are, so we don't have to think too much about this, but you can always go back to first principles and motivate those conclusions here based on, well, the construction that we just made. All right, so now we have tangential vectors and we have a basis on the hypersurface, and we have a normal vector. So overall, we have a nice basis of vectors on the hypersurface, and we're covered in all the directions that we can define. All right, questions at this point? Yep.
How is this E object related to the projection operator?
Ah, we'll get to that in just a moment. Yep. Yep, good question. All right, other questions? Okay, so let's just see how we calculate all of those things, and I'll go back to the sphere here as a way of illustrating what is done. So if we go back to the sphere, then the idea is that we take the constraint description of the sphere. That defines our phi function, and we use that to define the normal vector. So that's a straightforward calculation. So for the sphere, the phi function is equal to x squared plus y squared plus z squared. That's equal to a constant on the sphere. When I calculate the gradient of this, I'm going to get 2x, 2y, 2z for the components of the gradient. And that gives me a vector that's not a unit vector. So what I'm going to do is to normalize it, and I'm going to get my unit normal by just, well, doing the obvious thing, divide through by r, and get rid of the factor of 2, and that gives me a nice unit vector that I get directly from the gradient. And because the normal vector is, you know, is defined on the sphere only, I'm not trying to extend the notion of a normal vector beyond the surface. Here it would be appropriate to make the replacement coming from the embedding relations to emphasize the fact that this is a function purely on the sphere and nowhere else. So here I could just re-express this in terms of the parameter description.
The camera is freezed.
Sorry?
The camera is freezed. I do not see anything.
Okay. You mean it doesn't pan to the right?
Yes.
Okay. So how far can I go?
Right where you're standing, actually. That's the most right.
Okay. Thank you for telling me.
Change the camera angle.
Oh, that's fine. I can live with this.
Oh, they are adjusting it, apparently.
Oh, they are. Okay. So now you can see it?
No.
No. Okay, so I'll just pretend I don't have access to that board. So, just to repeat, in the sphere example, my phi is x squared plus y squared plus z squared. And that tells me that the gradient of phi is 2x, 2y, 2z. And that gives me the unit normal as x over r, y over r, z over r. And that's something I can re-express in the parametric form in terms of the intrinsic coordinates in this way. And again, what I was saying before is that this emphasizes the fact that the normal vector is defined on the hypersurface, on the sphere, and nowhere else. Okay, so that's the usefulness of this relation. And if we want the tangent vectors, then of course, we're going to use the embedding relations because that's how they're defined. So if we go back to the sphere example, then we have the embedding relations over here. And that will give us two tangent vectors, one that's going to be tangent to curves theta equal constant, and one tangent to curves phi equal constant. And we just take, we just calculate them by calculating the partial derivatives. So, and one important point here is that we don't normalize these things. In elementary, undergraduate descriptions of curvilinear coordinates, we would normalize all the basis vectors. Here, we we decidedly don't want to do that for a reason that I'll explain in just a moment. All right, so if I differentiate with respect to theta, we're going to get r cosine theta cosine phi. And then for y, we're going to get r cosine theta sine phi. And for z, we're going to get minus r sine theta. And then we get a second tangent vector that's going to be tangent to curves phi equal constant. And this we get by differentiating with respect to phi. And for the x component, we're going to get minus r sine theta sine phi, r sine theta cosine phi, and then zero for the z component. So those are our tangent vectors. And this was our normal vector. And we've covered all the directions, both tangential and normal to the sphere. So that's how we calculate these things. And then we'll consider more exotic examples of this later on when we actually do some curved spacetime versions of this. All right, so bottom line here is that we need those two descriptions of a hypersurface in order to easily have access to the normal vector and the tangent vectors, the tangential vectors. We could do without that one if we still have that one, because once we've defined the tangential vectors, all we have to look for is the unique orthogonal vector that that would complement the basis. So even if we didn't have that equation, we could still get a normal vector after the fact by just looking for the third vector that completes the basis. But if we have access to both descriptions, then we can do both calculations very easily. And it's usually not that hard to come up with both ways of describing the surface. All right. Okay. So let's move on. So now that we have the tangent vectors, and I have to remember to stay in that part of the class, we can define the induced metric. So I've already talked about this in a moment, but I want to introduce a notion of metric that will tell us something about displacements that are entirely contained at a hypersurface. And I want to define, distance relations when I make measurements purely on the hypersurface. And that's what the induced metric is. It's the instrument that allows us to do that. So very important notion. And the idea is here, is this. So here's my hypersurface. I'll call it sigma still. And what I want to do here is to introduce an infinitesimal displacement purely on the hypersurface. And I want to define the space-time, you know, distance associated with that displacement. So that would be a displacement, infinitesimal displacement that's confined to the hypersurface. So we have an infinitesimal displacement. On the hypersurface, so we're not wandering off away from the hypersurface. And what I want to do is to define a ds squared for that displacement. And just to emphasize that I'm defining this to be a ds squared that applies to the surface. So what do I do? Well, I know what it is because I know that in the full space-time view, if I can relate the dy to the dx, then I have a space-time metric that allows me to convert a dx into an element of proper, proper distance or proper time. So all I have to do is to relate dx to dy, and we've already done that, and that gave us the tangent vectors. So here's what we do. We relate dx alpha to dy a through a partial derivative. And we do the same thing for dx beta through a second partial derivative. And then we just collect things. What do we get? Well, we're going to get g alpha beta. That's the space-time metric. Of course, ultimately, the information comes from the space-time metric. And then we have tangent vector. So I'll just rewrite this as e alpha a e beta b. And then what's left over are the displacements in y. And it's pretty clear that what I'm defining here through that combination here is going to be a metric that will play the role of a metric for displacements that are purely contained to the hypersurface. That's what I call the induced metric. It's what, you know, gives us a specialization of the space-time metric for displacements that are specialized to the hypersurface and only those directions. And that's what I'm going to call HAB. And that's what we call the induced metric. And it's basically a way of getting rid of the extra dimensions that are, you know, normal to the hypersurface and defining a metric that applies purely to the hypersurface. So that's what we call the induced metric. Some people call it the pullback of the space-time metric to the hypersurface. It's the same thing. In mathematical literature, it's called the first fundamental form of a hypersurface, in spite of the fact that that's not a form. Never mind. So I like to call it the induced metric because it's clear that it's a metric that's inherited from the space-time metric when you specialize the displacements to a hypersurface. Right, so that's the definition of the induced metric. HAB is defined to be the scalar product between all the tangent vectors between themselves. And of course, it's understood that the metric here, space-time metric, is evaluated on the hypersurface. All right, so we can look at a simple example of this. If I want to calculate the theta-theta component of the induced metric for the sphere, all I have to do is to take the scalar product of this vector with itself. So I'm going to take the square of this plus the square of that plus the square of that. And I don't think we need to calculate very hard. We get rid of all the trig functions, and we end up with r squared. So the theta-theta component of the induced metric is just r squared. The phi-phi component of the metric well, now it's going to be this squared plus this squared. And now we kill the sine phi and the cosine phi, but we still keep the common factor of sine theta. So in this case, we get sine r squared sine theta squared. And you can calculate the theta phi component by taking the scalar product between this vector and that vector. And here you'll verify that it's zero. So the last one is zero. So if we define a line element that belongs to the sphere entirely, then that's something that we can express in this familiar form that you've seen before. That's the metric purely on the two-dimensional sphere. And, you know, we can do the same for any situation involving any surface in any curved space-time by just, you know, applying the steps. So it's very algorithmic and, you know, pretty straightforward, really. And we'll look at examples that are a bit more complicated in, you know, the next little while. All good? Okay. So the induced metric is clearly a very important object. It's the, you know, replacement of the full spacetime metric when we consider only what happens on the hypersurface. And it's one of those two things that we were talking about before that gives us a complete characterization of the intrinsic and extrinsic geometry of a surface in curved space-time. The only thing that we need to complement this is going to be the extrinsic curvature, and that's something we'll talk about. I don't know if we'll get to it this afternoon, but certainly next week. But yeah, clearly a very important geometrical object here. All right, let's see, where do I want to go from here? Okay, yeah, so let me go back to Connor's question. So once I have an induced metric on the hypersurface, I can do all of the usual things that we do in any curved space or space-time. We can take the metric inverse, we can take the metric determinant to describe volume elements. We can calculate Christoffel symbols from this metric, we can calculate a Riemann tensor from that metric, and all of those geometrical objects would characterize the intrinsic geometry of the hypersurface. So basically we would have an H, we would have a set of Christoffel symbols that would be defined in terms of that H in the usual way, and we would have a Riemann tensor that would, you know, be defined purely in terms of H. And those are all, you know, things that describe the intrinsic geometry of the hypersurface. So that's the geometry that we would define in terms of making measurements that are purely confined to the hypersurface, with no regards to what happens in the normal direction. And what happens in the normal direction is the bending of the surface in the underlying space. So that is what is captured by the extrinsic curvature, and that's what we'll come to in a moment. We could define the inverse metric, or inverse, you know, induced metric in the usual way. So that's just the statement that this is the quantity that when you multiply it as a matrix with the metric itself, you get the identity. We would have a determinant that would be involved in the definition of volume elements and various things like that, so we can define that. And one thing we could ask is, what's the relationship between the full space-time metric and the induced metric? And that will involve the tangential information, but it will also involve the normal direction. So I'll just write something down, and I'll call it the completion, or the completeness relation. And the idea here is to introduce a decomposition of the full metric in terms of the basic ingredients that we've just introduced. So we're used to the notion of decomposing tensors, and here I have a preferred direction which is given by the normal. So we're going to distinguish between the normal direction to the metric and the tangential directions to the metric. And if you associate the normal direction to a direction of time-like curves, well, that's very analogous to what we did for congruences, right? Except that now we're restricting ourselves to a hypersurface, and we don't necessarily care about the normal being tangent to curves, but you know, we could think of it this way. So all I'm saying here is that we can introduce a decomposition of the metric in terms of all of those ingredients we've introduced. And the simplest manifestation of this, or the simplest expression of this, is actually a decomposition of the inverse metric. So I can decompose the inverse metric in terms of normal and tangential directions. And in the normal direction, well, we just get two occurrences of the normal vector with an appropriate epsilon that will tell us whether that's a plus or minus one. And then for the tangential direction, that involves the inverse to the induced metric multiplying the tangent vectors. So I'll just, you know, state it like this. The way to prove this is basically to do what we always do when we introduce a decomposition, to make sure that you figure out all of the components systematically, including the zero ones, by working out all the inner products between your favorite tensor that you're trying to decompose and the members of the basis vectors that you're using for the decomposition. And I'll just claim that this is the outcome. I can, you know, let you check that you know, if you want to, but I think it's sort of obvious that, you know, we have normal directions, we have tangential directions, and because the normal is orthogonal to the tangential directions, there's no mixed terms in the metric. So that's what we see here. And if we think of this in the time-like case, and we associate n with a u vector, and we take epsilon to be minus one, then what we have here is a representation of the projection operator. So that answers your question. So that's something we can think of as a more explicit version of the projection operator that we would define in terms of the metric and, you know, the normal direction associated with the u direction when we associate that direction to the tangent to a curve that would be orthogonal to the geodesics. So that's just to say that the geometrical tools that we introduced before are sort of, you know, encountered again, but in a more specialized and more specific, way. All right, good. So it's possible we'll need that at some point in the future. So I just wanted to draw your attention to that. And then, you know, a challenge for you would be to check that this is the appropriate decomposition. Okay, so let me introduce a very useful construction that will help us in all sorts of practical situations. So let me make some room and I'll tell you what I mean. Okay, so let me introduce Gaussian coordinates. So I've emphasized before, and I'll keep emphasizing, the fact that sometimes it's very convenient to introduce a good coordinate system to describe or to perform, you know, to do a calculation that could be done, you know, otherwise could be done with covariant techniques. But, you know, probably with more effort and perhaps with less, you know, transparency. And we've talked about that theme when we talked about, Riemann coordinates, Fermi coordinates, all of those things. And there'll be more examples along those lines. And Gaussian coordinates is an example of this. And the idea here is that, well, suppose that I'm working around a hypersurface. I know that I'm going to have to introduce coordinates on the hypersurface to do all the stuff that we've talked about. But suppose that I'm interested in what happens a little bit, you know, away from the hypersurface. And I would want to introduce a coordinate system that would allow me to wander off a little bit from the hypersurface in the most convenient way possible. That's the purpose of the Gaussian coordinates. And it's basically, you know, a way of promoting the intrinsic coordinates from the hypersurface only to a neighborhood around the hypersurface and do that extension in a way that's the most convenient and the simplest possible. And that coordinate system allows us to do calculations very easily, and we'll see plenty of examples of that. So here's the idea. So we're going to start again with the hypersurface. And we have, you know, introduced coordinates that live purely on the hypersurface. And what I would like to do is to come up with a coordinate system that would give me a simple description of the metric, space-time metric, away from the hypersurface. We're going to wander off a little bit, but not too much, for a reason that I'll explain in just a little bit. So here's how we're going to do it. I'm going to take the hypersurface, and I'm going to identify the normal direction at each point. And what I'm going to do is to draw a geodesic that will be launched off from the hypersurface in those normal directions. So let me pick a point over here. The normal direction is, of course, normal to the hypersurface, and I'm going to draw a curve that's going to be normal, you know, following that normal direction, and I'm going to define the curve to be a geodesic in that direction. So here's one of them, and that's, you know, the reminder that it's actually launching off from the hypersurface in a normal direction. I have one over here, I'll have another one over here, and I have one over here, and it's basically everywhere. Here I'm drawing it going, you know, going away in one direction from the hypersurface, but I can imagine that, you know, they also go off below the surface. So the key point is that I want them to be launched from the hypersurface in the normal direction. So those are all orthogonal geodesics. I'm going to introduce proper time or proper distance on those geodesics, and I'm going to calibrate this by saying that when they hit the hypersurface, that proper time quantity is going to be zero. So here I'm, you know, drawing everything as if that's a space-like surface, so it's going to be proper time, but I'm going to introduce an epsilon and allow that construction to be valid also in the time-like case. So L is going to be proper time or distance, depending on the situation, measured on each geodesic, orthogonal geodesic. And just to be concrete, I'll say that L is equal to zero on the hypersurface. So I'll launch this geodesic from that point, and then L is equal to zero here, and then L is going to be proper time from there on, and it's going to be positively defined, you know, above the surface and negatively defined below the surface. So that's how we're going to think of it. So what I'm going to do is to use these coordinates and that as my system of space-time coordinates to give you that simplest description of the neighborhood of that hypersurface. So our Gaussian coordinates are going to be basically a special coordinate system that will consist of L and the intrinsic coordinates. The only thing that I'm missing now is how to extend the Y coordinate system that's now defined just on one hypersurface to define them off of that hypersurface. I need to provide an extension of the intrinsic curvature, intrinsic coordinates away from that hypersurface. And that actually is pretty simple. What I'm gonna do is to say that, well, if this geodesics, you know, intersected the hypersurface at, you know, one value, you know, once, you know, at specific values of y, I'm gonna make sure that those specific values of y are gonna be maintained on that hypersurface. So let me draw a picture to complement, you know, to finish off the construction. What we're gonna do is to say, okay, here I have my hypersurface and I have the normal geodesics that go off from it. What I'm gonna say is that, well, at this point I had very specific values for the YA coordinates. And I'm gonna insist that everywhere on that geodesic, we have exactly the same values for the Y coordinates. In other words, the geodesics are gonna be transporting the coordinates unchanged as we go from the hypersurface away from the hypersurface. And then what we could do is to, we could draw, you know, a different surface over here. And it's still going to be orthogonal to all of those geodesics. And that would be a representation of, of a surface L equal constant away from L equals zero. All right, so basically what I've done here is to introduce a fourth coordinate given my choice of three on the hypersurface. And through this construction over here, I've promoted my Y coordinates from a given hypersurface, the one that we start with, to a neighborhood of that surface in the neighborhood around it. All right, and then I could basically use this construction to write down an expression for the metric. And, I could do a very long derivation of this, but I think the final expression for the metric is gonna be very easy to motivate. The space-time, the ds squared for the entire space-time around the hypersurface, well, there's gonna be an epsilon dl squared coming from the directions normal to the surface. And then there's gonna be all the directions that are gonna be represented by displacements in the y-coordinates. We're gonna have a metric that describes this. That's gonna be a function of the L coordinate and the Y coordinate. And then, if this was, any other coordinate system based on, not this construction, but something else, there could be the possibility of having cross terms between DL and DY. But because I've made my choices here of maintaining orthogonality everywhere, between the L curves and the Y curves, I'm guaranteed to have a metric that will not have a line element that doesn't have any mixed terms. And that is a very useful construction that gives us a very simple metric. And the only relationship that we need to worry about typically between, the fuller metric here that's defined away from the hypersurface and the one we started with is the fact that, well, the induced metric we started with is simply going to be the restriction of the full metric or the full spatial metric here at L equals zero. So all I can say about the relationship between the induced metric we started with and the fuller metric that appears in the Gaussian metric is that when we specialize to the hypersurface by setting L equal to zero, then the ds squared have to agree with one another because we're using the same system of coordinates. And that means that g reduces to h in that limit. Other than that, I will not know the functional form of this, because that would depend on, all the underlying details of how, the space-time behaves around the hypersurface. But that's okay. I don't need to know more than what I just stated here. So, very good coordinate system. that is based on a very meaningful and very, you know, very revealing construction like this. And, you know, often people object to using coordinates to do all sorts of calculations. And I don't understand that rigidity in people because, you know, when the coordinates correspond to something geometrical and meaningful like this, based on clear choices like this involving those curves that we've talked about, then you know what the coordinates mean, and there should be no harm and certainly no shame in applying this coordinate system. We always have to pay attention to the fact that coordinates are in principle arbitrary, but sometimes they're not arbitrary. They correspond to meaningful constructions, and why not take advantage of that? So Riemann coordinates was an example. Fermi coordinates were another example, and that's another example of a meaningful coordinate system. And why not, you know, why not use it to our advantage when we can? So that's my attitude. You know, make your work less difficult when you can.
So this is, from numerical relativity perspective, this is equivalent to picking the lapse equals one and the shift equals zero?
That's right. Yeah. And that brings me to the point I wanted to make just before. That construction can be worked out and can apply very nicely in a neighborhood of the hypersurface, but you cannot use this coordinate system everywhere in space-time because of what's going to happen eventually with those geodesics. So if you start with any hypersurface in space-time and you look at the normal geodesics that launch from it, well, there will come a time. I mean, at least you cannot guarantee that, you know, it won't happen, but chances are there will come a time where those geodesics are going to start crossing because of the focusing theorem. And when you enter a situation like this and you find that geodesics are crossing, you have an event like this in space-time that corresponds to multiple choices of Y coordinates. And that means that as soon as this happens, your coordinate system becomes ill-defined, and that's translated by a metric that will go singular, and all sorts of bad problems will arise. So as long as you don't venture off too far and stay within the neighborhood of the hypersurface, you're fine. But if you wander off too far, then there's a chance, and it will typically happen, that geodesics are going to start crossing, and that will lead to a singularity of the coordinate system. So that's why, you know, people who do numerical simulations of space-time don't take a lapse of zero and a shift, lapse of one, a shift of zero, because this would happen in the evolution of the numerical code. And that would create all sorts of nasty singularities that will lead the code to crash. So you have to introduce a coordinate system that doesn't, you know, allow that to happen. And that's, you know, the art of finding good coordinate conditions to use in numerical simulations. But again, if we work just in a neighborhood of the hypersurface, we don't have to worry about those problems. In that neighborhood, we have a perfectly well-behaved coordinate system that gives us a very nice form for the metric. And if we use those coordinates in that neighborhood, then we can simplify all sorts of calculations. For example, if we want to express volume elements around, around the hypersurface, then in that coordinate system, I'll just write it as determinant G alpha beta in that coordinate system. Well, that's just going to be a product of this epsilon and the spatial metric. So it's just going to be epsilon times the determinant of the spatial metric. And if we specialize this to the hypersurface itself, we can define a volume element in four-dimensional space-time at that surface. And that would mean that, this reduces to the h quantity that I introduced before. So when L is equal to zero, this specializes to h, and we have that the determinant of the full metric is just a factor of epsilon times the determinant of the h metric. And, you know, we'll have plenty of occasions to see that this allows us to do calculations very easily because we were smart and chose to exploit the right coordinate system for that calculation. That doesn't mean that this coordinate system is good for everything, but for certain things it's really good. And again, in the spirit of making life easy, I say we're going to use it to our, you know, to our benefit. Okay, any questions about this? Okay, let me just specify a couple more things and then we'll be able to move on. In that specialized coordinate system, and that's why I'm using the star notation here on top of the equality sign, that's a statement that's valid in that Gaussian system of coordinates, we have a normal vector that points entirely in the direction of L, because L was defined to be the thing that varies in the orthogonal direction. So we have a very simple description of our normal vector, namely one component along L, no components along the YA directions, which are tangential. And the vector with the index down, well, all we have to do is to apply the metric to this, and we're going to get a factor of epsilon instead of one here. So that's the expression of the normal vector in that coordinate system. And then for the y, you know, the tangent vectors, well, then we're going to have three of them, and they're going to be in the coordinate directions YA in that specific coordinate system. So again, in that specialized coordinate system, we have a very simple description of the tangent vectors because we're using the YA, as part of our space-time coordinates description. So those partial derivatives, dx alpha dy1, well, that's going to be a partial derivative of either L or y1 or y2 or y2, y1, y2, or y3. And of course, the partial derivative with respect to of L is going to be 0, and the partial derivatives with respect to y2 and 3 are going to be 0, so you only get the 1. And then, you know, same story for e2 and E3. So all of those objects that we've talked about are very simple when described in terms of the, those coordinates. And that's why we're going to be, you know, describing them, you know, using them in future calculations. And then, you know, just to mention something that I mentioned before. So I've talked about the extrinsic curvature before. When it's time to talk about this, the extrinsic curvature is just going to be the L derivative of that Fuller metric here. So it describes how the metric changes as we move from the hypersurface and go slightly above or below. So, and that, you know, we'll talk about this more, but that describes the bending of the surface in the underlying space, and that describes the extrinsic properties of the hypersurface as opposed to the purely intrinsic properties that are captured by the metric and all the quantities we can derive from it. You had a question?
So can I always just do this? Like I you know, define some hypersurface on a general metric. I choose to use the same coordinates on that hypersurface that I had originally with the original metric.
Mm-hmm.
So I can have all of these E vectors just zeros and ones.
Yeah. So, I mean, so the intrinsic coordinates on the hypersurface don't have to be simply related to the space-time coordinates, but often we'll choose them to be the same or as close as we can to provide the simplest description. But in principle, they can be independent from one another, like, you know, Cartesian coordinates versus angular coordinates on the sphere. But the point is that, yeah, so once you've selected that system of intrinsic coordinates, you can always promote them to a neighborhood by this geometrical construction, and that can always be done. So it might be tricky to find a coordinate transformation between your favorite coordinates for the space-time and those Gaussian coordinates. It can be tricky to do that. But for all the calculations we're going to do, we're not going to be concerned with this because we know that, you know, in principle that exists, and we can just use the resulting form for the metric. And after that, when we established a few more things, we can go back to an original system of coordinates that's not Gaussian, but would be more practical to work with in applications. So I'll mention some examples of that a bit later.
Yeah, I just find in the literature that people often assume without stating that these E vectors are just zeros and ones, and they just use the projection operator and H alpha beta in place of HAB.
Yes, so you can always promote HAB to a spacetime tensor by doing the conversion with the E vectors, but they're not always zeros and ones, and we'll see examples of that. And the, you know, the test is simply to take the embedding relations, take the partial derivatives, and you get what you get, right? So if the intrinsic coordinates are exactly the same as the spacetime coordinates, that might be the case, but even then it's not always the case. We're gonna have an example of that coming next. Other questions? Okay, so those are Gaussian coordinates. And I think that's gonna be a good time to break because I'm gonna launch an entirely new topic in a moment. But let me just mention one more thing, and it's basically just a consequence of that over here. If I'm restricting my volume element, so let me talk about the spacetime volume element. In spacetime, that would be given by minus g times a product of the four, spacetime coordinates. I can specialize this to Gaussian coordinates, and I can specialize this to the hypersurface itself. So I can define a volume element that's going to be defined on and around that hypersurface. So what I'm saying here is that, well, to begin with, if I specialize to Gaussian coordinates, my minus g will be a minus epsilon h, right? Because g here, what I call g, is just the determinant of the spacetime metric. That becomes epsilon times the, let me keep it at that. So this would be, you know, the determinant of the four-dimensional metric, which I'm re-expressing in terms of the determinant of the three-dimensional metric times that factor of epsilon. And now I'm going one more step. I'm saying that let's evaluate this on the hypersurface at L equals zero, where this GAB becomes HAB. So what I'm saying from all of this is that, you know, a spacetime volume element in Gaussian coordinates evaluated at the hypersurface, well, that's what I'll call dV, and that's given by minus epsilon h, and then I have the product of the four spacetime coordinates, but now that will translate into a dl d3y. And that, I think, is something that we'll use in a moment or two. And I'll just remind you of the, you know, of the factors here, factor of epsilon, so minus epsilon h. So if we're dealing with a, you know, time-like surface, or let me say space-like first, if we're dealing with a space-like surface, then epsilon is minus one, because that's the, just to remind ourselves, epsilon is the norm of the normal vector. So if we're dealing with a space-like surface, that's a time-like vector, and therefore the norm is going to be minus one. So in the space-like case, epsilon is minus one. The minus here cancels that, and we get h in the space-like case. And in that case, h is going to be a purely, you know, HAB will be a purely spatial metric, and the determinant is going to be positive. So that works out. But in the time-like case, now my normal vector is going to be space-like. Epsilon is going to be plus one, and now we get minus one in the time-like case. And in the time-like case, HAB is going to be, you know, a metric with one time direction, two spatial directions, and the determinant will be negative in that case. So regardless, inside the square root, we always have something positive. So just to just to clarify a little bit what this means, it means that basically Gaussian coordinates with the right factor of epsilon inserted, as we have seen, that always take care of things so that you end up with all the right, you know, signs taken care of when you calculate things like that. Okay, so I think we'll stop here. This afternoon we'll talk about integration. We'll talk about integration in four-dimensional space-time, then integration on a three-dimensional surface, and we'll even bring it down to a two-dimensional surface, and we'll see how we can describe these things in a sort of nice, unified manner. So that will be for this afternoon.